guys. Welcome to Not Another Anxiety Show. I'm your host, Kelly Walker, and joining me to talk about fear of flying today is guest Tom Bunn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hi, Kelly.
Thanks so much for hopping on the show today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Do you mind if I share a little bit more about you with our listeners before we jump right in?
Okay, sure. Please go ahead.
Wonderful. So, Captain Tom Bunn, licensed clinical social worker, is a retired airline captain, licensed therapist, and contributor to Psychology Today and Time Magazine. He has appeared on Regis, Good Morning America, Fox News, NBC, CNN, BBC, CBC, and MSNBC. His book, SOAR, The Breakthrough Treatment for Fear of Flying, was chosen Amazon Editor's 2014 favorite book. His free app, A Mini Fear of Flying Course for Anxious Flyers, continues to get rave reviews. It also measures turbulence and reassures the user the plane is fine. So, a lot of our listeners have emailed me about, you know, fear, anxiety, and even panic around flying. And I knew you'd be the perfect guest because I myself have struggled with fear of flying and found your book, SOAR, incredibly valuable.
Well, that's great to hear. Thanks. I'm glad it's working for you. You know, you have to be a kind of a good student to be able to translate what's there into your own life. So that's a nice move.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have to actually have a half hour session or so with a person in order to make it fit with their own experience.
Yeah.
But the principles are good. You know, we have two ways to shut down the fear system. One that produces oxytocin, which is a peptide that will sort of put the part of the brain that releases stress hormones on standby.
Yeah.
And the other is a system that overrides the effect of the stress hormones.
And oxytocin, we know that is, right, the cuddle hormone, the love hormone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew you understood fear of flying on a deeper level than others out there because your book, your approach doesn't try to soothe our fear by telling us how statistically safe flying is. You know, if one more person told me, you know, you're more likely to die on the way to the airport, the drive there, than in the air, I was going to smack them. I was like, it doesn't matter. That doesn't mean anything to me. You know, I think statistics are maybe enough to calm like a very mildly anxious flyer, but my brain was way too strong for that.
Well, it's interesting you say that because statistics actually cause trouble because they all have that nasty little one in them. That's the one that crashed.
It's not 0%, right?
So, you know, you say, okay, there's one crash in 50 million flights, and you say, oh, yeah, I can completely conceptualize 50 million because I have $50 million or something. No, it doesn't work.
Right.
But you can very easily conceptualize the one. That one hits home.
It's that negativity bias, right? Like, even if there's just one, even if there's just one, it's easy to hone in on it.
Sure, when you hone in on it, when you focus on it and think about the plane crashing and think, what was it like for people on the plane? Then the next thing is you trigger the release of stress hormones in yourself. And then that's the beginning of the trouble, because when you're cool, calm, and collected, before you start thinking that, when you're cool, calm, and collected, it's pretty easy to determine whether you're perceiving something or remembering something or imagining something. Mm. For example, right now where I'm sitting, if I look out the window in the backyard, there's some trees there that are waiting for leaves, they're kind of gray. If I look out the side, I would see some hemlocks. Now, I'm remembering the hemlocks, see. I can perceive the trees that I'm looking at. So it's very easy to sense which you're doing. But then there's also imagination, whereas what if I wanted to imagine those trees that I'm looking at having leaves now, because they will in a few weeks. That would take a little mental gymnastics. And when you're calm, you know the difference. You know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But once, because you have to look inward to see what kind of processing you're doing. But when you get aroused enough, you stop looking inward. And whatever's in your mind defaults to perception. So you might start out, let's say you're on an airplane and it gets turbulence and the plane drops and you get some stress hormones. Then you think, well, the plane might be dropping, but it's just me imagining it's going to fall all the way to the ground. But if you get enough stress hormones, that imagination suddenly becomes very real, and you believe the plane really is falling. And that's easy to explain on the airplane. But you can also, a lot of people can at least, get enough stress hormones just thinking about flying to create the collapse of that looking inward. We call it reflective function. When you stop looking inward and your imagination of your upcoming flight then seems like it's reality, then you say, I just know my plane's going to crash.
Yeah. We kind of fuse with the story without even realizing it.
Yeah. You don't realize that you shifted off into your imagination, shifted off into reality. But, you know, think about every night you dream. And when you're dreaming, your reflective function is off duty. So whatever you're dreaming, you believe is real. But then you wake up and your high-level thinking kicks in along with reflective functions. Oh, yeah, that was dreaming. I was dreaming when that happened, so it's not real. But when we get enough stress hormones, we go back into that dream state. Even though we're wide awake, we go into the dream state where we believe whatever's in our mind is real.
Really alters our perception, doesn't it? I mean, it really alters our perception of reality in the moment.
Yeah, particularly because we don't know we did it.
Yeah.
You
just
see,
got caught up in it.
In order to know that we have shut down our reflective function and gone into making imagination real, we need reflective function to show us that we did that. But it's shut down, so we can't. It's a catch-22.
I was going to say, it sounds like a good old-fashioned catch-22. And you know,
exactly.
You kind of mentioned turbulence a bit and the fear of crashing, but fear of flying isn't always about like that physical safety, right? Sometimes it's emotional safety too.
Mentally crashing, sure.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so that the same principle applies, I think, too. Let's say you get enough stress hormones that your heart rate increases.
Yeah.
See, if you just have one shot of stress hormones, you go into the fight or flight response to get ready in case there's a danger or something you need to run from or fight off. But when you get 5 or 10 shots of stress hormones, you don't just get a slight increase in heart rate. You get pounding heart. Okay.
Yeah.
Pounding heart is not a panic attack. The panic attack is when you first imagine that you might be having a heart attack, and then you believe that you're having a heart attack.
Yes.
Now, our very, very basic way of regulating ourselves to deal with anxieties and feel safe is to escape. All right.
That's hard to do, right?
Okay.
We're not allowed to do that on the plane, I suppose. We're not allowed to jump out.
Yeah. Right. If you're in a building, and this happens, you know, people go into a building and they have a panic attack. If they get out, they're better.
Yeah.
But you can't escape the plane. And then similarly, you can't escape the heart attack. You can't run away from it.
Right.
So when pounding heart is imagined to be a heart attack, that becomes panic. When hyperventilation, instead of just recognizing, I'm imagining I'm going to suffocate. If you believe you're suffocating, that's
your panic
attack.
It rises to panic, right. It really.
Or similarly, when the stress hormones hit and you start losing your sense of self or feeling like you're coming apart, you think I'm going crazy. But what happens is that if your belief that you're going crazy actually becomes something that you think is true, then that's your panic attack. So we need to keep going into that state, which it's called psychic equivalence by Peter Feinege, who's a well-known therapist over in England.
Okay.
It's where you whatever's in your mind you believe is true, period. An example of it, he says that we develop reflective function, that ability to look inward and separate imagination from reality. We develop it beginning at about age 3. He also says that each of us develops it a certain amount. We don't necessarily all have really good, solid, robust.
Sounds like it's like on a spectrum.
Yeah. And so the stronger it is, the harder it is for stress hormones to collapse it. But okay, let's go back. Let's say if you begin to develop it at around 3, and so you've got a 4-year-old kid who now recognizes that he can put stuff in his mind that's not real. Now, guess what? That allows him to pretend.
Yeah.
But a 2-year-old kid, whatever the 2-year-old kid has in his mind, he believes is true.
Okay.
Now, it's an interesting thing Feinege says, which I think is kind of charming. A 2-year-old kid not only believes that everything in their mind is true, they also believe everything that's true is in their mind. See, it's kind of neat. But anyway, so let's say the four-year-old kid says to the two-year-old, let's pretend we're in the jungle and there's lions and tigers and they're going to chase us. They're going to try to eat us. Oh, there's one. He's after you now. The four-year-old kid knows that he created that tiger.
But it's a game.
He knows it's not real.
It's a game.
The two-year-old kid doesn't know that. The two-year-old kid believes it's totally real and he's going to get eaten, so he's going to go find mom to save him. So that's
cry,
the difference.
Go find mom.
So the from Feinecke's term is the two-year-old kid is always in a state of psychic equivalence. What happens to us when we get into trouble with stress hormones getting too high as passengers?
We're like that two-year-old, right? That's what happens to us, I'm guessing.
Too much stress hormones, we go into psychic equivalence and we believe our imagination.
Yeah. I wonder, is there a benefit to that? Like being, you know, if we're in the fear response and we go revert back to that state, I wonder, why does that happen? Is there some benefit to it?
I think you might have benefits to it if you are an artist.
Okay, an artist, sure.
I'm thinking of, it seems to me, I'm not sure if this is right, but I think Michelangelo was once asked how he came up with these beautiful statues he did, and he says the statue is already in the stone. I just take off the excess stuff. So for him, that figure's real. It's so real that he just reveals it. So it may be that if you're an artist, maybe that gets people into trouble because what you conceive becomes so real to you that you don't have to hold it there as much. It just sort of sits there on its own.
Right.
And maybe there is kind of a interesting crossover between certain levels of art, mental illness, where people believe whatever's in their mind.
Right.
That's a whole different subject,
sure.
I guess, than we should be talking about today.
Sure.
But there are a lot of artists really do struggle with
correlation
reality.
Yeah, so while we're trying to rationalize our way out of a fearful state, that's not usually helpful. If we're really in that high panic, anxiety mode, trying to rationalize doesn't always go very well. It becomes a bit of an internal conflict or argument. What can you tell us right now, while our feet are firmly and calmly planted on the ground, that might make the fear of flying a little less overwhelming?
Well,
what works on that intellectual level?
The thing you hit on is what happened back in the 80s when I was trying to find something would work, and I was using cognitive therapy.
Sure.
The problem was it worked for some people, but for clients whose anxiety peaked really quickly, their cognition just disappeared. They didn't have any cognition to do cognitive techniques with. So you're asking, what can we do rationally to try to hang on to this? And so what we're suggesting here is, how do you cognitively hang on to cognition when it's just slipping out of your hands,
not like very accessible
water through your fingers?
Yeah.
I think the solution is to cut down on the stress hormones. And that's, from, you know, in the book, one of the ways we do it is with oxytocin. So we inhibit the release of stress hormones. And that solves the problem. Because if you don't have the stress hormones, your thinking stays rational. Your imagination doesn't take over.
Yeah. So there is, while, you know, like I remember when I was kind of first reading your book, and geez, it was like 2 weeks before a flight, I would like lose sleep. I would feel like sick to, you know, it was like already primed by the time I got there. And all I had to do was leave my house and head to the airport. And it all felt so fast and reactive, like caught in that fear before I even really knew what happened. Like before I just even knew what was going on.
Caught. That's exactly what's happening. The fear first gets generated by a thought, but then it catches you because you start out knowing it's imagination, and then it catches you and takes you right into reality, and you just know that your plane's going to crash.
Yeah.
And once again, we got to find a way to stop the stress hormones. Now, a simple thing that you might be able to do is that exercise we call the 5-4-3-2-1. If you can pick it up quick enough, you can just turn and look at something straight ahead and focus on it. Use your peripheral vision and start naming things. First say, I see, and name something you see in your peripheral vision. And do that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Then you switch to what you hear, still focusing on something straight ahead. And name something you hear, say, I hear, name something, I hear, name something else, and so on. Then what you feel, what you touch, like I feel the phone on my ear, I feel my foot on the floor, I feel my elbow on the chair. So all these things are not stress producing, right? They're really dumb things right there in front of you that are no threat. So by focusing on totally non-threatening things for a couple of minutes, the stress hormones burn off. Then you have control again. But you have to catch it before it catches you.
Yeah, right? That's the hard part, right? Is kind of having that enough of awareness or just, just enough awareness or mindfulness to catch it. Because my gosh, thoughts are so habitual. Does it make sense to kind of practice this before we get overwhelmed?
That's exactly where I was going to go first or next. And that is that they sometimes say of firefighters, policemen, soldiers who go into life-threatening situations that in the stressful situation, you do not rise to the occasion. You descend to the level of your training. Mm-hmm. So let's say before you go into combat, you do the training so that when you get stressed, you just do what's automatic for you. Because what's stored in your unconscious procedural memory still works when you're stressed.
Kind of going to autopilot. We're still able to access autopilot.
Yeah, your high-level thinking gets fried, but your autopilot still works.
Still there.
Okay, so let's say that before you go into combat, you do this training. Okay, before you do combat with the airplane, you do the training.
And the simulations,
like
right?
You say, okay, you find an oxytocin-producing moment, and we can go into what they are in a minute. But if you remember Pavlov's dogs, he just rang a bell, fed the dogs. He did that a few times, and then even if he didn't give them food, if he rang the bell, they salivated. The same conditioned response. Let's say we link walking on the airplane to a memory that when you activate that memory will produce some oxytocin. So you practice this.
So we're doing classical conditioning here.
Exactly. Let's say you're going to fly on Saturday, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You run this exercise where you link oxytocin production to walking on the airplane, to sitting down in the seat, to the door closing, et cetera, throughout the whole flight. Then on Saturday, when you take the flight, you don't have to do anything at all. It's all done for you.
Your brain will just go there.
As you said, autopilot. Yeah.
Autopilot, yeah.
Yeah, and that's it's really fun when somebody gets back from a trip because they say, I don't think this is going to work. Well, we're so used to trying to control things, we just don't trust anything that's unconsciously controlled for us.
For sure. Hard to let go, right? And that fear moment to trust, hey, my brain, I've been kind of practicing and conditioning it, hard to kind of let go and trust that it'll do its thing.
I want more control.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
And so then when they get on the plane and they start saying, I should have freaked out by now, it feels very strange. And so they go through the whole flight waiting to melt down, and they aren't doing anything. It's just all being taken care of unconsciously. When they get back, it's almost like an altered state. They think, why did I not go crazy on the airplane? It's weird.
I can relate to that. I remember that first flight, and I'm like, why am I not freaking out yet? Well, I'm a little weirded out about that. It should have come by now. What the heck? It's like kind of, it feels like being in an alternate reality a little. Like, this is not what usually happens.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's fun to talk about it because it's certainly not what you expect. You think you're going to panic, and the fact that you didn't at all or even come close to it and you didn't work at it, it's like, oh my God. And then the question is, but are you going to trust that for your next flight? It may take a few flights for you begin to believe it'll work every time.
Right. To build that trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now there is a pitfall. A year later, when you haven't flown for a while and you start thinking about your upcoming flight, you're going to trigger stress hormones. And then this is going to seem strange. Now, wait a minute. On the flight, I was used to being taken care of without any problem at all. Now I'm having stress hormones. I'm having a setback. No, it's just the amygdala doing what it's supposed to do. It's going to give you stress hormones anytime you do something that you're not used to. So, yeah, that's something to expect. You'll get zapped the next time you plan a flight if it's been a while.
So it doesn't mean that we're failing or falling backwards. Mm-mm, it just means exactly. Your brain's doing what brains do when you do something out of the ordinary or out of routine.
No, it's doing what it's supposed to do to tell you, hey, something non-routine is happening. Yeah. Oh, by the way, let's talk about that. The amygdala, people tend to think the amygdala can tell you that you're in danger. Actually, the amygdala only notices change. It's kind of like a thermostat.
Gotcha.
If the thermostat notices change, it either turns on the air conditioning or the furnace.
The heat, sure.
Yeah, but so the amygdala only reacts to something different happening.
Even if it's not dangerous. So even if it's not a dangerous change. You know, I bet that's why a lot of people, like my husband, who never struggles with anxiety, after a long new drive, he's just like burnt out. He's like, I've been sitting all day, though. And I'm like, you know, I wonder if it's because it's just a very new environment, kind of being on alert for other cars, new drive, different drive. And he's like, gosh, I'm fried. And all I did was sit. And it's like, well, I guess the brain's probably pretty busy in a new scenario like that.
Yeah, and because what happens is that when you're driving, there are things that happen that set the amygdala off. But if you're in control of the car, if you can see, here's what I need to do about it.
Yeah.
At the moment the moment you make a decision, but it's actually the next moment. It's the moment when you make the commitment to your decision that you're high-level thinking in the prefrontal cortex, executive function, it sends a message to the amygdala. Says, okay, I just decided what to do. It's a done deal, so stop bothering me, kid.
Right.
So it tells the amygdala to shut up. And so people sometimes say, how come I can get on a motorcycle or do rock climbing or ski like an idiot and I don't have any trouble with that, but I can't get on an airplane? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because when you're doing these things, you're making decisions every few minutes. Well, I'm sorry, every few seconds. I'm going to, with a motorcycle, turn left, turn right, speed up, slow down.
You're
every
kind of
one
in
of
control,
those decisions
right? Is that the
tells
difference?
The amygdala, shut up, don't bother me.
Yeah.
So when your husband's driving, he's processing that, and he's unconsciously, he's keep telling his amygdala's being told again and again to stop the stress hormones. But he still has some stress hormones there.
Right.
So yeah, it kind of gets him worn out by the end of the trip.
Yeah. So it senses change, not necessarily danger.
Yeah. Stephen Porges, a researcher who I think has come up with some great stuff, talks about how the emotional system has developed over the many centuries. He says if you go back to the first system for defense or protection, he calls it the immobilization system. Mm. And we might call it freeze.
Yeah.
There are still, beetles, if you touch them, they'll roll over on their back, stick their legs up like they're dead.
Like playing possum?
Yeah, exactly.
Or those fainting goats.
Right. So, and then the next step in evolution was the amygdala. So here you now have reptiles, which have relatively little brain except the amygdala. So let's just imagine you and I are little reptiles and we're hanging around someplace where there's water and green things and we know each other, so we're used to each other, so we don't key each other's amygdala off. But here comes an apatosaurus. Oh my goodness, we haven't seen him before. We scatter. Well, yeah, but apatosaurus is a vegetarian, right? So yeah. He's not gonna hurt us, but we don't know that.
Right.
Well, see, Porges says, here's the problem. This is, by the way, the mobilization system. When the amygdala notices change, it produces an urge to run, and so you do. He says that's the mobilization system, and it's better than the immobilization system.
Step up.
Because it's better to run away than just to play dead.
Yeah.
But running away does two things. It exposes you to injury, and it burns up calories, which you're going to have to find a way to replace.
Yeah.
So now the next step, let's say immobilization is level one, level two is mobilization to run, level three gives us a choice between running or fighting or trying to control things. Now that we have mammals. So the mammal still has the amygdala and still has the same stuff going on with the amygdala. Every time something non-routine happens, let's run. But at the same time, the stress hormones give that urge to run. The stress hormones activate the high-level thinking that says, hold off, wait a minute, don't run. Don't run like a chicken with your head cut off, because now you've got a head. That's me. So I'm trying to be in charge here, so hold off. So do you see the body tension here?
Yes.
One part of the brain is saying stay and the other says
the conflict. It's like an existential conflict. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Right. But if the high level thinking can say, oh, I see this Apatosaurus, he's no problem, forget about him.
If
tells
it can
the amygdala
see.
That, the amygdala quiets down.
Sure.
Or if it says, yeah, this other creature is a threat, but I can handle him. I can fight him mm-hmm. off. That's okay too. But if you can't come up with a solution, you say, yeah, let's get the heck out of here. Now, that's a much better solution, but there's still a problem with it. And that is the amygdala reacts not only to the Apatosaurus, but to imagination of the Apatosaurus or anything else that's non-routine. And I kind of think that evolution made a mistake here. Why didn't it have blinders and only let us respond to what it sees? Why do we have to respond to what we imagine?
I know. It's crazy that this response is the same for whether the fear is real or imagined, you know, like watching a movie that we know is just a movie, our body still responds physically.
Well, yeah, maybe evolution figured on we were supposed to be smart enough to have our reflective function separate the two or three, memory, perception, and imagination. And it does. When you're calm enough, you do that. Now, here's what I think may be the linchpin here. When your cell phone rings, it's intrusive. It grabs your attention. But as soon as you answer the phone, it stops ringing so you can have a conversation. Imagine what it would be like if your cell phone didn't stop ringing.
Yeah. It's like when the fire alarm keeps going off and you're like, but I took the batteries out. Oh, this is driving me crazy. Yeah.
So let's look now at the amygdala sending off an alarm to your high-level thinking. It notices something that's non-routine. It produces stress hormones to grab its attention. As long as the level of alarm stays high, you can't think clearly, and your reflective function can't tell the difference between imagination and reality. So what we need is some software like the cell phone has, so that as soon as the alarm is answered, we quiet down. Well, you can't just wait for the stress hormones to burn off, because that would take a couple of minutes. So what is it that potentially can calm us enough so that we can tell the difference between what's real and imaginary? And that then is the vagus system, the thing
wanderer.
That Stephen Porges discovered. Porges discovered that when we're with other people, if they're sending us signals that we're safe with them, both physically and emotionally, activates our parasympathetic nervous system. We calm down totally, and our heart rate goes down to normal, even if there are stress hormones there. It overrides stress hormones, which is the key. So if we can set it up so that every time we're aroused, we bring to mind the face and voice of a calming person, a person who's sending us signals. Or have you had the experience of being with someone, your guard lets down?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's what's happening. When you're with them, you're picking up unconsciously, picking up their signals that they are totally safe for you to be with. There's nothing for you to be on guard about. And it calms you. So here's what I think we need to do to build in that software. In an ordinary day-to-day living, let's say today and tomorrow and the next day, there's going to be a few times when something happens that you're not expecting and you're going to get zapped.
Yeah.
So every time you get any amount of arousal, high level, medium level, low level, anytime you feel any arousal, immediately bring that person to mind. Notice their face, because that's where most of the signals are.
Okay.
And then imagine they say something to you like, hi. And in their voice, there are also some signals there. So if we train ourselves to have arousal, immediately bring to mind this calming person, we build in the software that we need, that the cell phone has, within our own emotional control system.
And this is, I'm guessing, when we kind of imagine this face of someone that we feel relaxed with or love mm-hmm. or safe with, that's releasing mm-hmm. the oxytocin in the midst of.
Well, is that right? In this case, this is neurological. Some of the people that we're with may produce oxytocin, but this is the one that activates the vagus nerve.
Okay.
The person's face is sending us signals that are processed unconsciously and activate the vagus nerve, and the vagus then activates the parasympathetic nervous system.
Tells us to relax a bit. Okay, so that's one way to, mm-hmm. when you've noticed yourself getting zapped, is to think of a face of someone familiar, safe, and that will kind of cue our body, hey, we're okay.
And I think this really replicates what happens in really good early experiences with a parent. The little kid is going to get upset once in a while.
Yeah.
If the parent responds consistently in a non-judgmental way, if the parent's presence is such that it causes the child's guard to let down, if there's that level of security, then arousal then becomes, here's mom's calming, which then is built in. So that what we're doing in good early childhood is arousal triggers calming.
Via
mom's presence. But on the other hand, if we're not too comfortable with mom, then when you get aroused, she might sometimes respond well, but sometimes she might say, well, you know, stop that crying or I'll give you something to cry about. And, and that doesn't build in, that doesn't build in calming.
That sounds like my mom, I'll give you something to cry about. That's why I'm laughing. I can really relate to that. And so when you mentioned the 5-4-3-2-1 earlier, mm-hmm. does that yeah. stimulate the vagus nerve, or what about that is, or does
no,
it just
that's
give...
really, it's really just a game you play with yourself to get your attention shifted to non-threatening things long enough for the stress hormones to burn off.
Long enough for that, you know, our prefrontal cortex to come back online.
Well, yeah, exactly, because except you're probably going to have a little bit of prefrontal cortex still in line to remember, oh, yeah, I should do the 5-4-3-2-1 now.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. It's sometimes just remembering, you know, if it goes from zero to panic, it can be so hard to remember, what am I doing again to help myself, like that very reactive mode. And when you mention oxytocin.
Really, it comes down to preparation. Then.
Yeah, practice,
you know?
Right? Preparation.
Yeah, practice. You say, I'll give you an example. I have a client from years ago. We have a thing every Wednesday night where we have a group phone session. And her name's Carol. She's a librarian down in Pennsylvania. And she said that I've got to go into New York to pick up some people at the airport. And since 9/11, I haven't gone through the Lincoln Tunnel. I've been driving all the way up to George Washington Bridge. Would this technique work on the Lincoln Tunnel? I said, sure. Yeah. So just get out a piece of paper and break down the trip into maybe a couple of dozen things. Like you walk out the house, you get in the car, you start up, you go down the driveway, you turn left at the corner, then there's a gas station, you turn right, then you get on the turnpike and so on. And so she did that. She linked it up to calming influence. Then a couple of weeks later, we asked how she did. She said, well, when I saw the Lincoln Tunnel, I did get a shot of stress hormones,
yeah.
but it went away, she said. And she went on through the tunnel, went to Kennedy, picked up her friends, came back. And she says, on the way back, halfway through the tunnel, her worst nightmare happened. She got stuck in the middle of the tunnel for 30 minutes. And she said, I was fine.
Now, didn't snowball, just didn't get the chance to snowball and build on itself.
She had linked her arousal to, and this is, I think, really, really a neat thing. When we have this group phone session every Wednesday night, it's people who are in the middle of this problem or have beaten it. The people who have beaten it are there to help out. And so it's a very, totally non-judgmental group. You know, if you have trouble with panic, you don't necessarily find non-judgmental people to hang around with. So here, everyone is totally safe. And so what she had done was she linked being on this chat with going through her trip to the Kennedy Airport. She linked it to the people she was listening to. In their voice, she was hearing those signals that were calming her, and she linked it to everything that's going to happen on a trip. So as she was taking the trip, we and the rest of us were psychologically active in her mind.
Yeah, almost there with her in a way, right?
That's, we were, yeah. That's yeah, cool. She had us in, built inside, yeah.
That's pretty cool. And so the oxytocin that you had mentioned earlier, where does that come into play? Like, what
well,
might that it, look
that's,
like?
That, see, that's the two systems. The system, which I think is the one we just described, that's the vagus nerve system. Yeah. Let me just hit something before we go farther. Porges calls it the vagal break. That is, if you got into a car with an automatic transmission and you put your left foot solidly on the brake, you could use your right foot and pump on the gas, put more gas in the engine. Car's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
So what he's saying is when the vagus nerve is stimulating, it slows the heart rate and activates the calming system. So it doesn't matter if you have stress hormones. Okay, so now the other system that prevents the release of stress hormones, oxytocin.
Okay.
And I said, okay,
so one's pumping the brakes and one's preventative.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So the oxytocin, nature has it figured out that there's certain times when it needs to shut down the fear system. And you think, well, what would that be? Well, what's important to nature other than just survival? Reproduction. So in the broad sense of reproduction, there are several situations that produce oxytocin. For example, when a mother nurses a child, it takes quite a while. What if halfway through she got anxious that she's a visitor's coming and they're going to give her a hard time because the house is a mess? Oh, I got to stop feeding the kid and nursing the kid and clean the house. That doesn't happen because when she starts nursing and all the time she's nursing, she produces a massive amount of oxytocin. The amygdala goes off duty, like taking the battery out of your smoke alarm. So she can't get anxious. Sometimes nursing mothers talk about that feeling of mellow.
Right.
Okay, then there's a second thing that oxytocin does in addition to shutting down the fear system when it's released, and that is causes bonding. When you first see a newborn child, oxytocin is produced to give you a feeling of connection with the baby and make you feel protective.
Mm.
And then
adaptive.
Also at orgasm, males and females both get oxytocin at orgasm. Now, obviously, it isn't to shut the fear system down at that point. It's to cause bonding so that the two have a feeling of sticking together so that if there's a child that develops out of this activity, then the child's got a better shot with two parents rather than one. Now, but then let's go back to the beginning of that episode. Let's say you go out with someone who you think is really attractive and you might think would be great to get physically close. But what if sometimes you go out with someone who you don't have that kind of attraction for, you don't think anything's going to happen. We're just going to be friends.
Mm-hmm.
But so there might be a certain amount of sexual interest in general, just sitting there, not applied to this person. And there's also a certain amount of fear and concern about getting physically involved with anybody.
Sure.
So you've got a certain amount of desire, a certain amount of fear, and it kind of balances out so nothing happens. But let's say when you are with this person and you really connect and you begin to produce oxytocin and the fear, all those concerns about getting physically close disappear. Yet the desire is still there. And the next thing you know, to your surprise, you realize that we're about to become very physically involved.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, and I love what Stephen Porges says, he says oxytocin facilitates reproductive behavior, unquote, in his scholarly PhD language.
That's a nice way to put it.
So,
that is the most polite way to put it, I think.
Yeah. But then now look at this one. Research, actual research. If you have a dog and you gaze into your dog's eyes and vice versa, you produce oxytocin. Now,
yes. I have
on.
Read that.
Did
why we've
nature,
evolved together,
did
right?
Did nature set that up for some reason? I don't think so. What happens is dogs just know how to do what lovers should do.
Oh,
they know how to look at us like we're the only person in the world.
They really do. They've evolved very well to be taken care of by us.
and the last one is that a solid hug lasting at least 30 seconds produces oxytocin.
Okay.
All right. So this is how, let's say you're cooking something on the stove and it starts to smoke. Your smoke alarm goes off. If you wanted to, you could open it up, take the battery out. That would stop it. So the amygdala is going to react to certain things, particularly situations where there's turbulence, situations where you close the door and you can't escape. There's a lot of things that the amygdala could react to. A particular, you know, the feeling of falling is just going to automatically knee-jerk give you stress hormones about that. Okay, so you can't necessarily reprogram it, but you can take the battery out. Okay. So what we do is we set up a procedure so that we link together the memory of an oxytocin-producing scene to walking on the airplane, sitting down in the seat, the door closing, et cetera, throughout the flight.
Ah, so we associate them.
Yeah, so let's say if you had the experience of nursing a child, you might just go back and remember it, pretend that you have a little black and white snapshot of an airplane taking off, landing, cruising, and you just go through them one by one, linking them to nursing the baby, to the baby's face there. Or if it's a sexual foreplay situation, as you probably know, guys always have pictures of airplanes by their face when they're trying to seduce you. So that's what you basically do. You just take that person's face and you put an airplane scene by it or a sexual afterglow there afterwards. Your mate has the photograph. Or if it's a dog, you sit down with the dog. And and by the way, you can print out these pictures. We have them on the website, excuse me, at fearofflying.com/photos.
And you can
print them out.
Print them out.
Sit down. Sit down with the dog. Put them by the dog's face and print them out. So that gives you at least there's 24 shots there. It's not maybe as good a complete a list as I'd like to have, but it's got the basics so that you link together the things that are going to be happening on the plane to the dog's face, so that your dog is there with you, calming you as you go on the flight and take it.
Yeah, I remember that one being particularly effective for me. That's what really stood out in the book was, and I think I used my dog. I mean, she passed away a few months ago, but oh my gosh, I loved her more than most people. So I would associate just her, you know, I would like have some photos of planes and whatnot, like the exterior, the interior, and just kind of hold them up to her when she's laying down. And I found that really effective, really effective.
Yeah, woman's best friend, because after all, the guy looking at you like that, you don't know if he's going to be that way in the morning, but the dog will.
I know. yeah. No, I love the oxytocin theory. Now, anything else to add or want to remind people where they can find you and scheduling sessions and whatnot?
Yeah, it's easy. Fearofflying.com is our basic website. And you mentioned the app earlier. It's got a lot of good stuff on it, including a G-force meter. You can find it on Google Play or in the App Store on Apple, but you can also find it if you go fearofflying.com/app. So there's two places. You remember the photographs, fearofflying.com/photos, the app, fearofflying.com/app will get you what you're looking for.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for hopping on the show. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
So that's our episode, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and take a minute to write a review on iTunes so that we can reach and support more people. If you're looking for more resources like one-on-one coaching, courses, or have a question you'd like answered on the show, please visit notanotheranxietyshow.com. You can also get a free ebook there by subscribing to my newsletter. And until next time, remember, be kind to yourself.